as I said, just the tip of the iceberg of where the...
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off into that conversation, we do have our usual announcements to make. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So please send your questions and comments to me by email to giascott@exogenynetwork.com. I promise I won't give out your full name or email, and I won't send you any spam. So don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And don't forget, there is a page on Facebook for all you Facebookers out there where you can easily post comments and ask for future topics. I also have an author page, and you can go and click like, showing me support for my written endeavors. And don't forget to email me directly, whether it's with questions for tonight's guest or about something else with the program. Send that email off to giascott@exogenynetwork.com. Now, tonight's guest is another author as we continue our author conversations. This time, just to get your heart pumping and your blood flowing, it's a mystery. I have read the book, and I enjoyed it immensely, but I did stay up too late last night reading it. So, without any more chatter from me, here is Kay Kendall.
Hi, I'm glad that you enjoyed my book immensely. That's a very nice word, immensely. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's a 50, almost a 50-cent word.
That's so, pretty near, yes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, so you want to introduce yourself to the audience and tell them a little bit about who Kay is?
Sure, sure. This is my debut mystery, the first book that I've published. I'm a child of the 60s, so you know I'm a little long in the tooth. I'm not 30, and I write about the 60s. I am living currently in Houston, Texas, and started writing this book about 3 years ago. The book's name is Desolation Row, and I picked that because it is the name of a famous Bob Dylan song, and all of my mysteries in this series will have titles taken from Bob Dylan songs, which is kind of a way to communicate, hey, this is about the 60s, without continually having to say it. If you don't know the Bob Dylan songs, then you may or may not want to read the books. I have some young readers who are interested because they say, oh, good, are there going to be hippies? And I say, yeah, there's going to be a hippie or two. You can't write about the 60s without a couple of those. So I spent my sort of day life, work career, as a public relations person working in Canada and the United States. And so everything I've always done has been based kind of on communicating in the written word. And I didn't get around to writing fiction earlier because when I was in college, one of my professors said, hey, Kay, do you write? And I said, well, you know, I think about it. And he said, well, if you haven't done it by now, you never will. So I thought, well, he knew what he was talking about. I was 20. I didn't know what I would have written about anyway. Back then, most writers were male and very serious. There was no chick lit. It was a very, very different world than what we exist in today. But I found that about 13, and I flopped around in my PR career and had interesting experiences and worked in Russia and took trips to Europe on somebody else's nickel because I was going there on business. Had a trip to Hong Kong, and that was great. Didn't have to pay for it. But I always felt like something was missing. And I went to a seminar once, and it divided us up into groups by our sort of innate things that we are real big strengths. And it turned out that something clicked for me that I thought, well, really, what I should be doing is writing fiction. And so I started doing it. I wrote one book that didn't sell. And kind of, you know, got disappointed. It's a lonely life being a writer. It's getting harder and harder unless you self-publish, which I thought I could always do. But I really did want to be published by a real press that said, hey, I think I can make money with her books. And so when the first one didn't sell, I took a little brief break and then felt I still wanted to write. So I decided I would write mysteries because that's my, aside from literary novels, mysteries, spy thrillers, things like that, that's the genre I enjoy the most. So I spent about 2 years reading nothing but mysteries, suspense, thrillers, spy things. So I kind of the tricks of the trade, I kind of got through osmosis. And then I started writing. And the result is Desolation Row, which just came out a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found it was a really interesting, it was far different from the things I usually read. I have to confess that up until fairly recently, I've read predominantly nonfiction books, which says I might be kind of boring somehow, because I didn't really read that much fiction. I used to, but I guess as the computers came out, more and more I started reading nonfiction books when I did read books and did a lot of my reading online. And it tended to stick to nonfiction for whatever reason. And just recently started reading more fiction again, sort of making a concerted effort to explore genres and whatnot. And mysteries usually don't appeal to me. I had a background in law enforcement, of all things. And so often I found they're really not very realistic if they involve police departments. So I kind of, you know, I had a little bit of an aversion to the whole mystery thing. So, you know, when I read Desolation Row, I was really surprised. It's kind of an, you know, an interesting twist because it's sort of like a historical novel, but at the same time, it is also a mystery. Because I'm a child of the 60s, literally, that's when I was born. So, you know, I observed the hippies and draft evaders and whatnot sort of from the child's point of view rather than the adult's point of view. So I found that the, you know, switching perspectives of that era was interesting too. So what made you dream up this particular, your hero and heroine in this story? What inspired those two people?
Well, I basically wanted to do something historical because that's what I enjoy the most. Something grounded in history, not a contemporary thing. I also, if I was going to write a mystery, did not want to get bogged down in the technology of today because I didn't want to have to do a lot of research. I wanted to go for the emotions of the story. So by going back to the 60s, I got rid of DNA and all kinds of gadgets that sleuths use now. And
that's very true.
Yeah, yeah. So it simplified things. I enjoyed the most reading about the time periods around the First World War and the Second World War. You put people under a lot of pressure, stress, extreme conditions, and interesting things happen and their real colors come to light. So given those interests of mine, there were only two wars left in this 20th century that were big ones that weren't done to death by other fiction writers. And that was the Korean War, which was pretty small and I didn't know a lot about, and it was kind of depressing. And then there was the Vietnam War, which I lived through as a young woman, and I knew a fair amount about. And not too many people write fiction about it. So I decided that was a niche that needed to be filled, and I would fill it. Uh-huh. So
I have to admit, I don't think I've ever read a book set in the 60s before, ever.
Well, there are a few around, And I had difficulty when I was trying to find an agent. They weren't keen on it. They also were definitely not keen that my book was set in Canada. Because the couple, the man was a draft resister and moved to Canada on purpose, and the agents knew that, I thought it was pretty silly for them to say to me, can't you put the story in the United States? That would sell better. And it was kind of like, no, the whole point of the book is they had to leave the United States. So I had, and then I had people saying, oh, Canada's so boring. You know, who wants to read about Canada? Now, there is now a very, very famous, well, she may not be famous. She's famous among people who read a lot of mysteries, a Canadian writer who people are just wild about. And so she's kind of breaking a path. But when she came to talk at a mystery bookstore here in Houston, I went up to her, Louise Penny, and I said, you know, I had this difficulty. And she just looked at me and she said, yeah, I know what you mean. I did too. She had to go to England to find an agent that liked her book. So, you know, there's a thing that once somebody's broken a path and everybody wants to do the same thing, but it's hard to get somebody to say, hey, I think I can make money with that book if it's not something that's been done to death before. And that's kind of annoying.
Yeah, Canada, but I did find it does a give publisher. You a different look at Canada, because I'm afraid that I live in Mississippi, so, you know, obviously in the South. I've never been to Canada, and, you know, when somebody says Canada, I sort of see this great expanse of white and polar bears. Now, the intellectual part of me knows that this is not a true vision of Canada. Canada is much more diverse than this. But that stereotype still lingers on in my mind. Even though, you know, I've talked to many Canadians, I know that their world is not all ice and snow and polar bears. I think a lot of Americans do have this set stereotype in their mind. And Canada's a cold place, and it stays cold all the time. And that's where polar bears live, you know. Is it true? No. just like, you know, any other stereotype, no, it's not true. But, yeah, it is. It did kind of make me shift how
That's
I regarded
good.
Canada a little bit. Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to do was to treat Canada like a foreign country, because I did live up there. I am married to a Canadian. And when I went up, everybody, all the Americans said, oh, there will be no culture shock. Won't bother you a bit. So, I mean, I was kind of young. I call it my young and stupid period. And went up expecting, I mean, there's a bit in the book where my character, Austin Starr, walks up to a mailbox and freaks out because she sees the English royal family crest on the red mailbox. And it hits her that this is not home. This is not the United States. Now, that may sound silly and stupid, but that actually happened to me. I thought, my God, what have I done? This is a foreign country. It is not the 51st state filled with snow, Eskimos, and polar bears. This is a real foreign country. And the differences bothered me for a very long time because, you know, I'd been promised I wouldn't, you know, it would feel just like home, and it didn't. Now, if you put Canada on a scale of foreignness, Canada and the U.S. would be over on one side, true, and Mozambique and, you know, all kinds of exotic places would be at the far end. That is not to say that the tiny differences aren't real between the U.S. and Canada. The history is very different, and that history has made the two countries different. Canada never revolted from England. They're still very tied there. Their language, the way they use English, the way they build buildings is very much related to the United Kingdom. So it's different. And that's what I wanted to show. I wanted to show Americans that, you know, our neighbor to the north that we often take for granted is a distinct country.
Yeah, and some little things that we take for granted, like you talked about their red mailboxes with the royal crest. We're very used to blue mailboxes with that U.S. Postal logo on it. To not see that would be somewhat of a shock. And isn't their money's really different, too, if I remember correctly. Some of their small coins are similar to ours, but the others, you know, their money is colored. I still have a hard time wrapping my mind around the idea that the only country with monochromatic money is us in the U.S.
It was when I went up there, you know, there were lavender and pink bills and some green and all kinds of things. And now, I mean, they're wild. I mean, it's kind of plastic and you've got a hologram in the stuff. When I lived there for quite some time, I got used to the different colors. And so then when I'd come back down to visit my parents or friends, everything was, all the bills were green. And, you know, it took me a day to kind of figure out, oh, don't grab the five and think it's a 20. But there are little differences. And there was, when I lived in Western Canada, people were, at the time anyway, not particularly anti-American. When I moved to Ontario, when you move east, you get a lot of anti-American feelings. There's a joke in Canada about living next door to the United States is like, you know, being a flea in bed with an elephant. When the elephant rolls over, you better watch out.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I guess those of us who live in the United States don't regard ourselves as being particularly threatening. You know, and the whole way I think everybody regards the world, though, is changing because of the internet, the easy access to material from other countries, to conversations with people in other countries. I think it's really kind of made the world a smaller place.
Oh, yes. A couple of years ago, I think maybe it was five. I mean, it's in 5 years in internet and technology time, it's quite a long time. But
uh-huh.
About 5 years ago, I read some story that said, you know, there was this kid walking along in, oh, I don't know, Kashmir or something, some place that I thought was pretty exotic and they were kind of poor. And he had on Adidas sneakers and he was listening to a Walkman and bopping along to some hip hop song. And that shocked me. And I thought, whoa, you know, this is a different world. Now, another thing I wanted to prove in writing about 1968 was that is a time long gone. It is historical. There's a rule of thumb that if you're writing a history novel, it needs to be 50 years in the past. Well, my view is that's almost 50 years, but such a 50 years of so much change, you know, it might as well be World War One. I have my characters running around trying to find payphones. What that does to your lifestyle, I mean, we forget if we were alive back when there were no cell phones, you take for granted so many things now. And even back in 1968, there weren't even answering machines. There were a few. I had to do research on that. But there were a few, but they weren't widely available. So
if I remember correctly, 1968, I lived on a farm, and we still had a party line.
Okay, there you go. Right. Yeah. I mean,
you know, I could be wrong, but if we had gotten rid of it, it was maybe 1967 that we did, because it was about that time period when the party lines went away, and we suddenly had a private line.
Yeah.
More.
Very nice.
Someone listening in. Yeah. So, you know, people today, most of them haven't had the thrill of sharing a party line with people you don't even know. You don't know who they are.
And boy, do they listen.
Oh, yeah. And in small towns, you know, especially like in the case of my family, my mother was unlikely to know who they were, but they sure knew who she was because she was from outside of the area. So she was quite, you know, the oddity to begin with because she was practically a foreigner. I grew up in Iowa, and my mother was from New Mexico.
Oh, so, that would be.
Oh, yeah.
Quite exotic.
Plus, she was not a German-American. You know, this is like, whoa, she's really foreign. So, you know, that was just something that, you know, was the norm for us as kids. I didn't realize that other people didn't even get to experience this peculiar life. So, you know, reading about
Are you there? Gia?
There, I think I'm back.
Oh, good.
I sort of wandered off.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, there's so many things that have changed since 1968. Things like you're giving the muffin to the kid on Halloween. You couldn't do that today.
That's right. That's right. There'd be a fear of a razor blade or all kinds of nefarious things. That's
right.
Right. And back then, Halloween was not a big commercial enterprise. You didn't decorate. I mean, you might put out a pumpkin, but it was all very low-key, uncommercialized.
And when I was a kid, it was very typical. You would get cookies and real popcorn balls, not the ones made
right.
of marshmallow, the one made of that cook syrup stuff.
Absolutely.
That I've never had the nerve to make myself, yeah. Caramel apples. I have to admit, I never saw a candy apple until I was an adult. Caramel apples was the only thing I'd ever heard of.
Yes, me too.
So,
well, I grew up in Kansas, so I think that Kansas and Iowa are, you know, kind of birds of a feather.
Yeah, they do kind of share a lot of the same cultural and even farming background because it's similar crops were grown in both places.
Right, that's right.
So there's a lot of cultural similarities. Yeah, so, you know, there's many things that shift and change. And, you know, talking about, you know, Canada being so foreign, about a decade ago, I moved from Arizona to New Orleans.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, not only are you talking about a change in geography, but you're talking about changes in flora and fauna, changes in accents, changes in English. I had to learn to pronounce things entirely different.
Chapatoulas.
Yeah, Chapatoulas. It's Burgundy Street, not Burgundy.
Oh, right. Right.
You know, lots of little things. Yeah, it's Calliope Street, it's Calliope Street, not Calliope.
Uh-huh.
You know, little things like that. And there's a lot of social mores that will shift between regions too.
Yes.
Even between, like, say, New Orleans and now I live in Mississippi. Things that are okay in New Orleans, in small town Mississippi, no, not okay.
Right, right.
Definitely.
My, I didn't know an awful lot about New Orleans until my son married a girl from there. And we went frequently for the wedding. And then he got posted to Iraq and she stayed with her parents and had our first grandchild. So we went often. And she tells the story of before she met him, she went up to New York City. She was there with a girlfriend, and they were in a bar. And they hadn't finished their drinks. So she went up to the barman, and she said, "Can I have a to-go cup?" And he said, "What do you mean?" Well, you know, you can wander around New Orleans with a drink in your hand. But
right.
That's pretty rare in the United States. And he was just stunned.
Yeah, the one thing that we did with everybody that came from out of town to visit us is we took them to the daiquiri shop in the drive-thru.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's an entirely different way of regarding it. I have to admit, you know, in terms of beverages, daiquiris are really nice on a really hot, muggy day, and New Orleans has a lot of them. It's kind of like drinking a milkshake with a kick.
Yes.
But it was something that always just floored people. You know, I can remember when to buy anything besides beer and wine in Iowa, you had to go to the state liquor store, which was open like 3 days a week from 10 to 3. Okay.
Oh, my. 10 to 3.
And my dad, and I remember seeing this as a kid, he had a license issued by the state of Iowa, and apparently this stopped in the late 50s, early 60s. He had a license that the state would issue someone permitting them to buy alcohol.
Wow.
You know, and alcohol in Iowa was kind of late coming on, I guess. You know, it was, you had to bring your own bottle into bars for a long time. And this is stories from people older than me, because obviously I wasn't old enough to, you know, go from being born to drinking in the same year. But, yeah. Anyhow, this is the kind of changes, you know, in the way we perceive alcohol. And we're seeing sort of the same shifts in terms of even the marijuana, because, you know, back in the 60s, okay, you were going to jail, and it was bad, bad, bad. It was a horrible thing, and now we're seeing many states are legalizing it where it's nothing much at all.
So well, I wasn't sure I would see that in my lifetime, so I'm a little surprised at that. Now, mind you, I'm deep in the heart of Texas, so I'm not going to see a lot of these things for a long time.
Deep in the heart of Mississippi, so
yes,
I'm not
yes.
Between my breath for the change to come to Mississippi. Yes. Mississippi is notoriously slow to accept change. I mean, they just abolished slavery within the last year. So
right, pretty much.
Yeah, we're not real quick to change here, so
yeah,
I'm not holding my breath on that one. And we still have dry counties, too, so just like Texas does.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, some things we're going to see change in other states faster than others, and that's the way it's kind of always been. Certain
always
states
been.
Like to watch and see how well it goes on the other ones before they fall on that wagon, too, I guess. And Texas and Mississippi both are known for being rather conservative. So
yes,
it just makes sense.
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge to live here sometimes. I am in Houston as a whole is blue, not the suburbs, but the urban core.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blue city. We have a gay mayor. I had friends in Canada when our mayor was elected. I didn't know it was gone. She's up for her third term. I didn't know it was going to be that big a deal. I had 10 friends from Canada and Europe email me and say, hey, Houston, good for you. And I thought, well, of course, everybody was kind of taken with our conservative image, and then we had the first lesbian mayor. I can't remember if it was the first gay mayor period in the United States or not, but it was quite surprising to people because it went counter to a Texas image. And I was proud of that. I was also very proud of how Houston stepped up to the plate after Hurricane Katrina. Because we accepted lots and lots of people from New Orleans, and Dallas did not.
Yeah. I happened to spend time in Texas as well, because I lived there when Katrina came to visit. But I wasn't in Houston. I was actually up in a little town called Jefferson.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by Lake of the Pines. Okay. Anyhow, it would have been a nice place to visit if I'd been there for any other reason.
Right.
However, it was a very long month while I was there.
I'm sure.
Yeah, so, you know, things like that do tend to shape our culture. And even the way laws are written, the way people talk about things, it's more than just our history. And I'm sure Canada's got things that shape them just as distinctly as Katrina helped reshape the Gulf Coast.
Yes.
You know, and it's kind of new for Americans, I think, to really think about Canada in terms of, instead of being our stepsister, half-sister, whatever you want to call it, that it's, you know, something just as distinct as our own country is, maybe even more so, because it may not have the quite the same regional differences that we have here. We even have, like, Louisiana with its Napoleonic law. That's completely unlike any other state in the Union.
Yes, that's right. So there are regional differences. By and large, some of the same things happen in Canada, the West, in the East. Differences are still kind of pertain up there. But everything's a little muted because, by and large, Americans are much more boisterous, bombastic, forthright, outgoing. There was a columnist in Canada who used to say that Canadians were Americans on Valium. and there's a certain amount of truth to that. When you go to a restaurant in Canada, and if it's filled with people, it will be a lot quieter than if you went to the same size restaurant, almost any state in the Union. It's going to be louder. And my husband, who's Canadian, has lived in the States for 23 years now. And when he goes back home, they say, "Bruce, you've gotten American because you talk a lot louder." And he does.
I guess I never thought about how boisterous we really are. You know, people are often floored when I tell them that in my family, I'm regarded as sort of a doormat, that I'm not real assertive, you know, compared to cousins and aunts and uncles and even siblings. And they kind of look at me askance and they're like, I can't even imagine somebody being more like a bulldozer than you. You know, and I am much more quiet. I tend to not say a whole lot, you know, and it's just the way I have always been compared to the others. I mean, the others are much, much more assertive, aggressive, noisier, outspoken, et cetera. And I tended to always be one of the more quiet ones. And, you know, if you think of all Americans having families like, you know, my own even, I'm kind of like, oh, boy, yeah, I can see why we would be a little loud compared to Canadians. You know, is there more than, you know, behind it than just volume? Is it different when you have to deal with as many rude people, say, as we do in the United States?
Well, I think opinions would differ on that a bit. When I lived in Ontario, and I lived for a long time in Ottawa and also in Toronto, I thought that Ontarians were not particularly helpful, not very outgoing. I think they've loosened up a bit. But when we took a trip down to New York City about, in the 80s, I'd say, went to New York City, famous for rude people. They were so nice and so helpful. It was just astonishing. And my husband felt the same way. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say. It, for sure, they aren't like chatty Southerners.
Southerners tend to be chatty. And to a degree, Westerners are too. And spending most of my life in the West, I spent a year in Minnesota when I was 30-something. And I thought, oh, my goodness, why do I keep running into all these rude people? They're grilling me for information. It's like none of their business. And it took a while before it sank in that they're asking where I was born, where my parents were born, what they did for a living, where I'd gone to school, et cetera. They weren't being rude. This was not an interrogation. They were trying to be polite. Well, in the West, asking questions like that is something that's culturally just not done.
Yeah.
You don't normally do that.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating if you're tuned to this kind of thing, the kind of regional differences that there are, and in the social mores that grow up, that what's done in one area is not done in another. I think it's fascinating. I personally find people and what they do and how they turn out as endlessly fascinating, but I don't give a hoot what makes a car engine go or how a cell phone works. It just bores me to tears. But endlessly fascinated by human beings.
Yeah, I make my husband crazy because first, when somebody does something that is really annoying or causes a problem or whatever, I'm like, well, why would they do that? And he's like, what difference why do they did it? You know, now we just have to deal with it. And I'm like, no, I want to know why.
Yeah.
Why did they do that? What are they getting out of it? You know, and that's just me. I'm the perennial three-year-old. You know, I'll never outgrow why. And I do. I'm curious about why do people do that things that they do. To me, that's much more interesting than, as you said, how a car works. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people, I know exactly how a car works. A car works by magic. I have a magic talisman that I stick in it, and it makes it go. And periodically, I have to go buy magic potions at the magic potion store, and then sometimes I need other magic potions added into it, and then every once in a while it breaks and I need a magician. Well, the magic talisman's my key. The magic potions are oil and gas and water, and the magician that fixes it is the mechanic.
That's right.
Explains it, as far as I need to know.
Yeah, I totally agree. I talk about black boxes, you know, if there's a black box and inside magic works. And, you know, it's fine with me. I don't care as long as there's somebody around who can fix it and I can keep on trucking. I think you and I are sisters who have never met, Gia.
I'll tell you what. You know, I understand the basics of internal combustion. There's micro explosions, et cetera. Just don't ask me to put it together or touch it. It's greasy and dirty and it smells bad.
That's right.
Yeah. Coming from, a family, my dad was actually a car dealer, and my brother and sister both were immersed in the shop as often as they could be. I was the oldest, and I had zero interest in that. That was like stinky, smelly, dirty stuff. Yeah, give me a book. I was the bookie kid.
Yes, yes. Well, speaking of books, tell me what you thought about, you thought mine was interesting. Did anything surprise you?
Actually, the big surprise was the whodunit.
Oh.
Yeah, that was the big surprise. I mean, I hate to give away the story to anybody else that hasn't read the book yet, but the whodunit at the end was like, oh, wow, I sure didn't see that coming. You know, it made sense, you know, once you got to that point. But, you know, it did kind of leave you, were like, who did it, who did it, who did it? There were so many possibilities. And, you know, the one you thought was the nut wasn't as nutty as you thought. it was really, really a big surprise. I wasn't anticipating that as the ending. So, yeah, the whodunit at the end was where I was surprised. Because I have to admit that probably for a long time through the story, I thought that Austin's husband, I forget what his name was now.
David.
I thought David had done it.
Well, you know, I tried to write the book that way, and I just... it was awkward, and I didn't really feel like I had the skills to pull that off. So if you still thought maybe he did it, that pleases me. So maybe there was like a hint of that left in. I took took a couple of things out. Actually, when my editor went through it, she said, this isn't working. You haven't built that up enough, so you need to let that go. So that's cool that you thought he was still a possibility.
Yeah, because he was acting so guilty in the beginning of the story, and he was acting so oddly. And really, everybody believed that he had done it except for his wife.
Right, right. And there was a little, that's what I took away. I took away the fact that the first way I wrote it, about a third to a half of the way in, I thought she was going to have this little niggling thought that maybe he did it. But she only gets real shaky at one point when her horrible mother says, well, you just, what makes you think he didn't do it? You know, and she hangs up on her mother.
Oh, and I so totally related with that hard to hang up on somebody.
Right.
You know, I've had pretty cursing out for no reason, and I haven't hung up. I continue to try to get a word in edgewise. You know, and I'm like, why am I such a glutton for punishment, you know? You know, what is so hard about pushing the button to hang up the call?
Because it's rude. We're
yeah.
not supposed to be rude, but you
right.
need to protect yourself sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm sure most people at some point or another has had a friend that's gone off the deep end or become increasingly irate about something that maybe you did or didn't do. It doesn't make any difference. But for whatever reason, you end up with this person screeching at you on the phone. Actually, I had a really amusing one I went through periodically for about a year. This woman would get incredibly drunk and call me and accuse me of running around with her husband. I have no idea who the woman was.
You didn't know. Oh, gosh.
My concern was, she got my cell phone number. Did she get my address? Because I don't know who she is or what she's talking about, but crazy women, they scare me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And she was definitely off the deep end. You know, I finally told her, lady, I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know who you are. I don't know who he is, but that sure wasn't me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have literally no idea who she is. She insisted that my phone number was on her husband's phone calling him.
Ooh,
and, you know, I know it wasn't because it was my phone, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know who she was talking about. So, yeah.
Well, you know, when I was writing about draft resistors and doing it in a calm, uncritical way, taking them as just ordinary, nice people, I thought, I was worried that people were going to screech at me. And even though a lot of water has gone under the bridge, it's still kind of a taboo thing that you don't do what your country tells you to do. And I thought that I might get really dinged by some people. And I have yet to have anybody write a review online or say anything. I haven't uncovered that at all, and I'm really surprised.
It is still a pretty sensitive topic, and I'm surprised with the amount of time that's gone by, how hot of a topic it can still be.
Yes.
Draft resistance is probably a hotter topic these days compared to even gay rights.
Well, it's not talked about that much, though.
No, but as far as how heated people's feelings become very quickly.
Yeah, like a stigma.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, true. True.
You know, and it's something that's brought up during every political campaign still.
Yeah, what
day.
Did you do in during Vietnam, right?
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I did a little research, and I found that, you know, I had to find out what the status of draft resistors was today and if it was, you know, if somebody came back, what would happen. And it's in different pieces, layers. But the Marines actually found somebody who had deserted in during the war. He was living in Florida. They found him and they prosecuted him in 2005.
Uh-huh.
And
so it's not
I'm,
a totally dead topic.
Yeah. I'm not sure, but what I read was that the people writing about this in the newspapers guessed that the Marines felt like they had to do it and take a stand because of the war in Iraq. They didn't want to set a precedent. They had to say, we draw the line here. This is not acceptable.
Right. And, you know, with the talk over the last few years about the possibility of the draft being reinstated, I don't expect the Vietnam era draft resistance gain a lot of ground in terms of respectability and whatnot, because there still is a lot of really bad feelings towards it. And I think it sort of lingers on because of the general population's dislike of the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard for families that have lost someone in a war since then, Gulf War, Iraq, wherever, to not be angry at someone who deserted or was a resistor during the Vietnam era.
Right. And I have a great deal of sympathy for that, to think that, it's very hard if you've given up a child or a relative, and then somebody turns around and says, that was a useless, worthless war, and you've given up somebody you love. That's really tough, and I totally, totally understand that. So I have to look at it from different perspectives and at different levels. What I was trying to do on the war subject, all wars in my mystery, was to be pro-soldier and anti-war.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there were a couple of people in the book who were veterans of World War II. And there was somebody else mentioned who died in the Korean War. And so there's a lot of war stuff that's not just Vietnam. I tried to put a lot in the book so that you realize. I mean, we tell
the 60s was an era of a lot of war veterans. There was all the World War II veterans. There were still, most of them were still alive, the ones that had returned from the war anyhow.
And they were
there was Korean War veterans, and then we had the Vietnam War going on.
Right.
Now, for me as a child growing up during that era, it was kind of a horrific thing because, to me, the mass media was reducing the value of a human life. They would do the football scores in the same tone of voice and presenting them on the screen in much the same way they presented the death count in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. U.S., so many dead, so many wounded.
Right.
Viet Cong, so many dead.
Right.
And it was really, you know, just keep in mind, I'm primary grade age during this time period. It was pretty horrific in a way because you were just beginning to understand dead, really. And, you know, you would see boys from the local community go off to war. And then you would hear that they'd been killed in Vietnam. Because in the little town I grew up in, it seemed like if they went off to war, they never came home. I don't know what the deal was, but it seemed like there was a lot of fatalities from that little town.
Hmm.
But, you know, you keep in mind that each graduating class was like 30, 40 kids. So you send those boys off to war, you know, what are the odds that 10 boys out of X number of 1,000 could potentially end up dead? And that it seemed to be there was a lot of them. So, you know, that was just the way, you know, a small child was seeing it on the television screen. You know, and it was really kind of frightening to, because I remember one time a kid that worked with my dad got drafted. He came bursting into the house in the middle of the night, drunk and whooping up, scared my parents half to death, and it was just him coming to tell my dad that he'd been drafted, you know, and he was leaving, I guess, the next day or something. I don't know how quickly all that happened. As a kid, it seemed to happen instantly. It was like the recruiter was there snagging you and dragging you off as soon as you were drawn for the draft. And, you know, I'm sure that's not a correct perception, but again, that's one from a child's point of view. It seemed to be real fast. So, you know, seeing it as these resistors would go to Canada, well, Canada's not that far from Iowa, but it seemed to be a long ways away, too. You know, it was a foreign country. And it was something you heard of on the money, and they had moose in polar bears. You know, that was about all you knew about it. And they had this maple leaf thing that they were so fond of. But you really didn't get it at all because it was a foreign country, obviously. So it was interesting to read a book that was set in that setting, and yet it was Americans that played as the hero and heroine. And, you know, so there was an American flavor with the Canadian maple leaf, I guess.
Right.
And the comments about, you know, she needed to learn more about hockey.
Yeah. You know, I wrote that two versions of that book, and only on the third go round with my editor did I think, oh my gosh, there was nothing in there about hockey. And I thought, you know, if this is going to feel like the real Canada. So, you know, when she walks into the restaurant, the guys are talking about the maple leaves, you know.
Yeah.
Through the game and what a mess and get rid of the coach and all that. So, and it was very easy to ask.
Hockey's not a hot sport in the South.
No. You don't have the history of a lot of ice.
No. I guess probably in this little town I live, I'm probably the only one that grew up ice skating because we happened to have the rink block from our house when I was a kid growing up. So,
this blows my mind. My husband grew up in and around Winnipeg and Calgary, far north of the 49th parallel. And in the winter, it'd be minus 30. They'd throw water out on the snow. It would freeze. They'd scrape it off, and they'd have their ice rinks in their backyard. And that's how people learn to skate and play hockey. And I saw it once in Quebec. I was taking a train for business from Ontario to Montreal, and the train had a problem, and it got stuck for an hour and a half. And right outside our window was one of those homemade rinks. And the teenagers were just, you know.
The town I grew up in, they flooded the softball field.
Yeah.
They flooded it, and they'd flood it, usually around Thanksgiving. And as soon as it got good and cold and everything was frozen, and we would skate on it all winter.
Really?
So, yeah.
In Iowa?
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. Well, it just amazed me because in Ontario, people would say, well, you grew up in Kansas. You're used to winters like this. I said, are you crazy? No. No. If you get 10 inches of snow outside of Wichita, I mean, in the old days before we had crazy weather patterns like we do now because of, I believe, global warming, it just wasn't that cold. It just wasn't. We didn't have that much snow, but the Ontarians were convinced that Kansas was just the same.
I'm thinking it was the winter of 65-66. I could be wrong in the year, but we had a lot of blizzards in northern Iowa. Keep in mind, I lived right along the Minnesota border, so it's northern Iowa. And the snow drifted so high, it completely covered an elm tree that was beside our house. And we had a two-story house with an attic. And you could walk from the roof to the snowbank.
Right.
We sledded.
My husband talks about that. Their eyes get as big as saucers.
Yeah, in the 70s, we had snowbanks that killed most of the livestock in the area. We got like 20-foot drifts. But it is time on that cold and icy note for us to take a break. So folks, hang on to your keyboard. Don't move a muscle. We're going to take our short break, and we'll be right back with more conversation with Kay Kendall.
Thank you. join us in the chat room, visit paltalk.com. Go to the social issues, select Other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello, this is Angela Thomas with a message about living life to the fullest. As a psychic clairvoyant, I often give insights to one's career path, financial situation, or relationship. Whether one is happy or not in their current situation, where he or she is right now is an important part of learning valuable lessons that can lead to fulfilling one's life purpose. If I can offer you insights, feel free to contact me at 636-278-2272. Again, 636-278-2272, or visit my website, angelathomas.org. I'm considered a psychic, so I provide accurate held psychic readings for individuals as well as groups. Remember, no matter what influences your life at the moment, live life to the fullest. Stay in gratitude, count your blessings, and prepare yourself for more opportunities in the corner. I'm Psychic Angela Thomas, and my website is angelathomas.org.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests, authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Whoa, 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 my love, she comes in colors. You can tell her from the clothes she wears.
Hello, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and along with my co-host, Victor the Voice Furman with Second Sight NYC. Victor, who do we have as a guest this week?
Chris, our guest this week is Pamela Osley. She's an expert on auras and what they mean.
Could you give me an example on that?
Yes, well, for example, red is a color of strength, passion, and creativity. People with predominantly red auras approach life with gusto, seizing opportunities, and living for the moment.
Well, I always heard that people with red auras need a preparation H.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Breaking news, strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated. I'm scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchard, bringing you the high strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Kay Kendall. But before we go off to our conversation again, don't forget you can send your questions in to my email, giascott@exogenynetwork.com. And Kay, would you tell everybody where to find your website as well as your book, Desolation Row?
Okay. Desolation Row, you can find online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Kobo, K-O-B-O. And it's available in ebook format and as a paperback. And it, my website is www.kkendallauthor.com. And my name is spelled K-A-Y. K-E-N-D-A-L-L. And I'm also on Facebook. My author page is Kay Kendall Author.
Okay. And she's also got a post up on the Dawn of Shades radio show page on Facebook. So if you forgot anything, you can find her right there too. And go and take a look at what she's got up on the web. Now, Kay, before we jump off and go too far away from everything else, a huge facet of the culture of the 60s was all the turmoil and social unrest and demonstrations and all of that kind of thing. This book didn't feature a lot of that. It was a much more sort of peaceful thing. Is there a reason you left it out, or did it not happen so much beyond the north side of the border?
It was much more laid back and out of the action. And I did not want to get into the politics. I didn't want to write a hard-edged book. There have been those, and I think people don't like them very much. I wanted to show what a turbulent time did to ordinary run-of-the-mill people, people that weren't really screaming radicals, or the husband obviously has strong political views that have taken him to Canada even before he got drafted. But they were caught up in this whirlwind of political and social change, and even their lives were altered as a result. And I purposely went with kind of middle of the road people to show that even they got turned upside down.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because I think it did have rather broad
sweeping effects through culture, in the United States especially, because the demonstrations and whatnot at the universities, at least, you know, from rural America, which is where I was at that time, and keep in mind I was a child too, but it's sort of, the kids from the community, I don't think were encouraged to go off to universities in the same way they had been in the 50s or would be in the 70s because of all that social stuff, and they were sure the commies were going to get them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I went to the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas, and I graduated in the spring of 67, and everything up to that point in time, Kansas was not Berkeley. The year after, students burned the student union. I could not believe it because there was nothing there when I graduated. It was kind of Columbia University. All hell broke loose, even in Kansas. So that really astonished me because Kansas is not, well, it's pretty radical now, but it's radical far right instead of far left. It's, you know, it's a rural agrarian society, kind of calm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I find interesting is, I thought, with aging baby boomers, they're going to want to look back on their youth, and they're ready to read about it. In my demographic, on a blog that I wrote a guest post for, I had a lot of comments coming in, and a lot of the women readers, because it was a blog of like six or seven fairly famous mystery writers, all female. The commentator said, thank you for writing about this. I'm going to take a look at your book. However, I ordinarily don't read about the 60s because I was burned by it and I don't want to relive it. And that surprised me. I mean, these were women. These weren't draft dodgers. I mean, who knows if they, you know, tried to rock the Pentagon or whatever. They said, I don't want to relive that time. I was really surprised. They had a hang-up about it.
Well, in a way, when you think about the 60s in terms of the culture of women, which is different than you might say than the mainstream culture, women were in a state of flux then. This is before you were supposed to be the superwoman.
Right.
You weren't really just a homemaker, but you weren't really accepted in the workplace. You were subjected to an incredible amount of sexual harassment. Even the things that I endured in the 70s as a teenager, today is not tolerated in schools. But it was in the 70s. You know, trying to explain to my daughter the differences. You know, bra snapping was nothing in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for boys to come up behind you and snap your bra in school or something like that. You know, there was a lot of really things that really made girls uncomfortable and a lot of intimidation still going on. But it had to have been worse in the 60s before women were really being that well accepted in the workplace, in especially non-traditional jobs. It was fine if you were a school teacher, nurse, or secretary, but don't be the policeman and expect to become a detective someday.
Right. You know, that's a very fascinating point of view, Gia, because I was so focused on anti-war turbulence that I didn't think about sexism and the coming feminist revolution. Because I was blinkered. I was set on 1968. But in the book I'm writing now, that's what I get into because it's set in 1970 in the middle of a women's liberation group and somebody gets murdered. And Austin Starr's best friend, Larissa, who you meet in the first book, Desolation Row, she gets accused of doing the murdering of the women's lib leader. And so I feel like my first book was kind of war and the turbulence of the time. The second one takes on women's lib. And I have been keen to write this book for a really long time because I did join a women's liberation consciousness raising group in the 1970s in Canada, and it changed my life. And I've just been dying to write about it for ages.
Yeah, you know, years ago I wrote a blog, I actually titled it that Billie Jean changed my life. I've never met Billie Jean King. I will probably never meet her. I don't even know if she's alive, to be honest.
She is.
But, you know, people look at me really funny when I say that. And people, a lot of people read this particular blog post. But it was because she began a shift in the way I regarded my own options for life. You know, and you know, I did write a letter to the editor about how it wasn't fair that the boys had sports in junior high and girls didn't. And it was published. And I developed a really thick skin because I would be humiliated in class by the teachers for being a woman's liver, for wanting to play sports, for rocking the boat. And it was against the law in Iowa at that time for them to do that, but they'd still been doing it. And they brought sports in for girls the following year. Did I make the change happen? I doubt it, but it might have helped make people aware that some of the girls had strong feelings about it. Would I do it again knowing that I was going to be harassed that way? Probably not. Not as a 12, 13-year-old girl. Oh, no. It was so humiliating. But it did learn, it did teach me to not let public opinion sway me, to develop a thicker skin, to speak my mind, and, you know, let the chips fly where they will. You know, so I did learn a lot, and it was a formative experience in learning how to deal with that. And that was about, must have been 1974, 75, right in there, when I had done that. My sister and I both did it. And the editor of the local newspaper happened to be friends with my parents, and he published both of our letters with our names. Thank you very much. And we both enjoyed it. She got it in the elementary school, and I got it in the junior high. And, you know, it was very, very difficult. And that was just one little issue in one little small town. Population 3,000 if everybody was home from church. You know, and the thing is that seeing the things that she was doing did help change the way I regarded my own options. I was no longer limited to being a nurse or a school teacher. You know, I could do more than that. I've never been a nurse. I'd be a terrible nurse. I don't like sick people. I don't even like me when I'm sick. Teacher, I did actually consider doing that, but I never have done it. So, you know, it shifted the way I regarded the world entirely.
And I think it's important we remember that that's very recent and that things were different, because I think a lot of people don't think about it and don't realize how much things have changed. And I'm astonished to see forces trying to push us back.
I find it really appalling.
Oh, I'm just astonished. I just don't know what to do. I'm so surprised. And the misogyny seems to be pretty deep in a lot of men, and it's very upsetting. I remember in the early 70s in women's liberation groups, there was a movement that they said, we're going to teach women how to do abortions because one of these days it's going to be attacked and we need to have safe abortions because women are going to go out and kill themselves by mistake otherwise. And I remember thinking, oh no, we've gone past that now. Everything's okay. That will never happen. Well, what did I know?
And it's funny that the sheer number of people that do not understand that a person can be anti-abortion but pro-choice.
Right. Because well, it's very simple for me. I don't have to go beyond this. There will always be abortions. It's whether or not they're going to be safe ones for poor women. Rich women will always fly or go to wherever they can get their abortions.
Right.
Poor women will go to butchers or try to abort themselves. It has always been that way, and it will never change.
And, you know, I've heard about some of the old concoctions that women would use to attempt to miscarry or, you know, induce a spontaneous abortion. They're probably lucky they didn't kill themselves.
Yes.
You know, how many times did it result in damage to the fetus?
Right.
You know, and really it's an issue that I guess my general opinion is you can't legislate morality, but you can make it where people can make a safe and sane choice.
Yes.
I can't answer for other women's situation. It's not my job to determine. And I don't think it's the government's job. So, yeah. There's my abortions. I'll probably have all sorts of upset people today.
Yeah, probably so. But let's just top it off by my quoting Gloria Steinem. Who said, if men had babies, abortion would be a sacrament.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay, I can remember some of the things I said when I was pregnant with my daughter that horrified people. I said, I feel like I have been invaded by a space alien. Okay, this is no different than those sci-fi books. There is something inside of me, and it's growing, and it doesn't like me very much right now. And, you know, they thought I was unmotherly. I was really attacking motherhood or something. And it's like, no, I'm talking about the physical sensation of being pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
These women that were so ecstatically happy and thrilled and everything, no, I felt like a whale with a space alien in me. And, you know, it was physically, it was very demanding on me. You know, it was not an easy process for me. Now, I do understand that some women don't have that sort of unpleasant, physically speaking, experience. It didn't have anything to do with my feelings towards my daughter. You know, I love my daughter very much, and I have since the day she was born. But, yeah, I can still laugh about the feeling like I had a space alien.
And
no.
I think it's not uncommon to read that now, you know, by comedians saying that, female comedians, or just bloggers or commentators in general saying, you know, this is a weird experience. That back then,
30
I'm
years
sure
ago,
if you
it was, yeah, yeah.
Said it to people, you know, nose to nose, that they were maybe horrified.
Yeah, I definitely wasn't run-of-the-mill. By that point, though, I'll have to admit, I was already used to not being run-of-the-mill, so it really didn't bother me. People looked at me funny. Yeah, non-conforming has sort of become a habit by the time I had my daughter, so, you know, it was like, you know, a routine for me to not conform to social norm, yeah. So, you know, I guess in a way I can relate to people that did choose to be pioneers in changing our society. You know, the sexual revolution with the advent of the pill. Do you think that had a huge impact on the way people started regarding the world?
The world? The pill?
Yeah.
Do
you think it changed society in any fundamental way?
Yes, because it allowed women to get free. They didn't have to be, we didn't have to be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen all the time. Possibilities opened up. And if you look at sexual politics in pure power terms, that may be why men, some men, feel so threatened, because they want the old patriarchal way of looking at things, where at least I can control my own wife. I am the king of my castle. And they can't even take that for granted anymore. And I thought everybody'd gotten used to it, but evidently not.
Well, you know, recently we watched some old episodes of All in the Family, and anybody who was old enough to remember when it was on TV, it was quite scandalous, at least in the small town opinion, because, you know, they did things on TV that had never been done before. I think he said the word damn. It was some damn or shit or something like that. That was a first time thing. They heard a toilet flush on TV for the first time.
And Edith got raped, I think, or at least manhandled.
Yeah, and you were looking at the changes that were happening in America, and it was set in a single household. They had the daughter that was involved in Women's Lib, the son-in-law that was trying to be kind of hip and with it, but, you know, kind of missed the boat on Women's Lib a few times. It's a very traditional couple, you know, Edith and Archie, and you know, how completely she was ruled by him. She didn't even know what to say. She didn't even have an opinion unless he gave her one. And,
right.
You know, that was not uncommon when I was a kid. Women didn't have opinions about anything other than maybe cake recipes or how to do the laundry. I mean,
and bridge.
Well, bridge, I mean, I didn't know anybody that played bridge, so I missed out on that one. But, you know, in general, they just didn't have opinions. They had no opinions about local politics, nothing. And maybe that was why it was okay for me to be a nonconformist, because even my grandmother had been politically active. And she talked about when women got the right to vote. And people don't realize how recent that really was.
Incredibly recent in human terms. Very, very recent. And you could argue it was only because of the First World War. Because women had to, the guys went off to fight, the women had to fill in. And they showed that they could be useful outside of raising children. And then as soon as all the guys came home, you got to slam right back into the house after World War One, and strongly after World War Two.
Well, they wanted those jobs for all those returning soldiers, and if
yes,
the women
stayed
in the workforce, they weren't going to be. And sometimes I wonder if that's not why we're seeing that shift in society again. With the economy the way it is and the shortage of jobs and the number of unemployed, that if some of this anti-feminism that we're seeing doesn't really boil down to economics by forcing women out of the workforce, then men will have jobs again. And it's a similar motive behind them sending them home after World War II.
Yeah. That probably has a lot to do with it. I think women's liberation has changed things so much we just barely understand it. I remember when I would go to my consciousness raising meetings, the big ones, and then I'd go to my small groups, and we'd talk and bare our souls. And I never said this, but I kept thinking, who's going to take care of the children? Well, as far as I'm concerned, these days, nobody is. Children raise themselves. And it sounds very anti-feminist to say that, but it's very difficult to work and raise your children adequately. I mean, you're busy all the time, and unless you really put a big emphasis on family life, which a lot of people don't anymore, they're scattered here and there, and everybody has his or her nose in a cell phone or a tablet, nobody's getting civilized. And this is a big hobby horse of mine, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, kids are just running rampant, and they're being raised by each other, the mall, and television that says they need to look and live like a Kardashian.
Well, and two, you're seeing a real big shift in society. When I was a young woman, if someone called you a bitch, it was an insult. Now it's apparently supposed to be a compliment. To be rude and unpleasant and even physically aggressive to the point where you're bordering on assault is now considered an admirable trait. You know, and you know, when you start getting like that, you know, when it's all about me and nothing about anyone else, you're setting society up for a huge problem.
That's what I'm calling not being civilized.
Yeah, because anybody who goes on Facebook sees this all the time. They have these little things they post with the sayings and whatnot. And women are continually proudly wearing this bitch label. And I'm like, why? What are you, I mean, are you really proud to be known as unpleasant and rude and selfish and inconsiderate? I mean, are these really qualities that we want to encourage in our daughters and granddaughters? I don't think so. I still don't think they're what I would consider a quality. I would consider them things that needed to have the old-fashioned attitude adjustment applied to. You know, and I don't think that it's a good thing for our society to see this shift in regard for how people behave. It's nice when you are out and about and you don't have to listen to foul language and you don't have to put up with rude behavior and when people do act civilized.
All we need is people to act by the golden rule. You know, how do you want to be treated? You treat your fellow person like that. And now you mentioned the golden rule, which when I was growing up was mentioned a lot in positive terms. And now if you mention it, somebody snorts and says, oh, yeah, you know what the golden rule means? It means he who has the gold rules. And that's almost true.
And it's things like, you know, the nice guy finishes last.
Yeah.
Nothing in our society is talking about cooperation, about patience, consideration for others. You know, all the things that were drummed into previous generations from the time they were old enough to be drummed.
Are you coming back?
Well, I'm back again. I blinked out there for a second.
Good. You know what I think is interesting? I think a lot of people might hear you and me talking, Gia, and think we were pretty radical before we got on this topic. But if you heard us talking now,
they would think we were extremely conservative.
Yes, they'd say, listen to those two old fuddy-duddies.
Yeah.
I don't find it inconsistent. But other people might. And maybe it's because you and I come from Iowa and Kansas. I don't know.
Well, you know, even in the South, you know, which traditionally is known for
manners,
hospitality, courtesy, et cetera, you're seeing this admiration for the aggressive, unpleasant, inconsiderate person, be it male or female, to be honest.
Really?
Mm. And it's rather appalling in a lot of ways because, you know, civilization is the sheer veneer that we have over our primal self, you might say, but it's also what allows society to function by sort of smoothing over everybody's bumps and lumps so that
right.
we don't clash as frequently. And you know, I'm going to react far differently to someone who speaks to me in a courteous manner than when somebody, you know, is shrieking at me and using four-letter language.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to get two entirely different people. And, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out which one is going to be easier to deal with.
Yeah.
And that's true for most people. You know, if you, you know, go to talk to them and you're rude and nasty and use inappropriate language, you are going to get the same thing back.
Yes. And if you deal nicely with clerks and customer service people, I'm almost sad now, because if there's a little glitch and I wait patiently at the drive-thru bank, I get thanked so profusely. It's pitiful, because I think what that's saying is I'm abnormal, because most customers would be swearing at the woman or saying, hurry up, hurry up, what's the matter with you? And I just sit, you know, it's not worth getting upset about. And on the one hand, I'm delighted that I've made somebody's day a little pleasanter. And on the other hand, I'm thinking, oh, you poor thing, what do you have to deal with as a rule?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I was always taught was, this saying about the sign of a true great person is how they treat their subordinates.
Yes.
And, you know, this may sound a little strange, but when I'm looking at political candidates, you know what I look at? One of the first things before I even look at what their politics are. Everybody has staff. Political candidates who have a high turnover of staff, they don't treat them very well. And if they can't treat their own staff well, how can I believe that they're going to treat their constituents well?
That's right.
And that's a very simple thing. You know, and I look at that in terms of companies I do business with as well, because unhappy employees tend to be unpleasant to deal with. Companies that treat their employees well are usually reasonable and easy to deal with. They're doing their job. You know, we all know of a certain big box discount store that you go in and you expect to be treated rudely if you can find an employee that doesn't turn around and run when they see you coming. You know, and that's the whole thing is, you know, why do people continue to accept, not only from their politicians, but from businesses, they accept poor customer service from the businesses, and they accept poor response from their political representatives as well. And I think I've blinked out again.
No, I can hear you.
Okay, I just didn't hear you for a second, and I thought, oh no, I've blinked out.
There was just a pause.
The thing is that, you know, I think we need to expect more. You know, if people start demanding courtesy from coworkers, from their children, from their parents, you know, and start dishing it out as well, I think we will start seeing a much nicer society.
We could, but the pressures are such. You know, the world is filling up with people, and the pressures for just basic things like water are going to start to be really extreme. And my husband would say, oh, there she goes again. It's all gloom and doom. But I see trajectories that aren't very pleasant. I don't see a lot of counter trajectories that say, hey, this is really going well right now. I see worsening weather, worsening budgets, worsening education levels, higher and higher. You know, we're at 7 billion now. The next billion is going to hit us faster than ever. And these are not good trends. And when you put a whole lot of rats in too small a space, they go crazy.
Yeah, you know, I have
to admit,
I wasn't really well cut out for living either suburban or urban life. I was too much of a country bumpkin, I guess. I'm much more comfortable in a small town environment. But the town I live in now has got 18,000 people. To me, that's not truly a small town.
to me, a small town is less than 1,000. There's not very many of them left now. If they're that small, often they're gone, or they've grown and far exceed that today. So our world is changing. There's less and less wilderness. There's less and less open, free space. I got a big shock in the difference between moving from Arizona to New Orleans and then to Mississippi, because in Arizona there's lots of public land that you have access to go out and hike and walk and watch the cows and the other animals and you know, whatever. You can just spend, you know, an entire week out in the boondocks and never see another person. That's not true here. There isn't that, none of that kind of open space in Mississippi.
Really?
No. I mean, you can get it remote into the woods and swamps and stuff where you won't. But there's not that. It's almost everything is private land.
I see. Yeah,
and
the West has a lot of.
Yeah, the West has a lot of public lands that don't exist in the East.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there is less open land. There's less, you know, our national forests and our national parks have been under threat for everything from logging to ranching to minerals, as well as reduced budgets, poaching, vandalism, all sorts of problems have plagued our public parks and recreation department, state, county, national level, all of them alike, as their budgets have been continually cut because of the economy. You know, when is it going to happen when they are no more? If we don't start protecting them a little bit better, our grandchildren certainly aren't going to be able to enjoy them the same way we did.
Oh,
there just isn't that much open land left anymore. You know, if you try to find a piece of prairie today, yeah, even though I grew up on the prairie, I saw an acre of it once.
Yeah.
You know, natural prairie just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. There is a, I forget the name of it, right outside of my hometown in Kansas, there is a natural prairie federal park that was just put together in, I'd say, the last 15 years. And they're letting the blue-stem grass grow long and so on. But it's just a pinch compared to what it used to be. But at least it'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the cities that are pleasant and livable are the ones that 100 years ago somebody had the foresight to say, we're putting aside Central Park in New York City. We're not going to develop it. Houston has Memorial Park, where the soldiers gathered before they marched off to World War I, and it's in memory of those people. And it's not as large as Central Park, but it's a big open space with trees and running trails and polo grounds and things like that, right in the middle of Houston, which is a huge city that everybody says is run by developers. And thank heaven we have that in the middle. I'm sure lots of people would like to build condos up on it, but they can't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know Houston is a big, big city. If you want to travel through the greater Houston area, it's like hours.
Yes.
You know, we're not talking about, I mean, even I used to think the Phoenix metro area was big, but compared to Houston, it's a little cow town.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It is the fourth largest in the United States. And one of these days, for better or worse, we will pass Chicago.
Well,
I don't think we'll ever pass LA or New York.
In terms of square miles, are you sure it's only the fourth largest? The greater
no, I'm talking population. In,
okay.
In land mass, I put this on my Facebook page once because I was so astonished. There's a list of about 10 cities, major cities in the United States, that Houston could contain. You know, like Boston and Philadelphia and Cleveland and Cincinnati and on and on and on.
Houston is absolutely massive. In a,
yeah.
You know, unless you've physically driven through it, you never will realize how absolutely massive it is. you know, when you first get into what appears to be an urban area, you're still like 2-3 hours from Houston proper.
Yes. In all directions.
Yeah. I mean,
with the exception of Galveston down on the coast because you hit water. But that's an hour in, well, 30 minutes to 45 minutes, depending on traffic.
Traffic is a big depending on. Yes. Traffic there and the way the roads were, I always found Houston confusing. I don't get toll roads. I couldn't figure out how they worked. You know, I have to admit that I just would often take the long route because I couldn't figure out the silly tolls.
I've lived here 23 years and finally have one of those easy pass things on my car. And so life is a lot simpler. I don't use them very often, but when I want to run up to the airport or out west to see a friend, now I don't have to worry about figuring out the tolls. I also just breeze by with my easy pass on my car.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, for people who are not familiar with toll roads, it becomes very confusing. And there again, coming from the desert, I still find ferries confusing. I haven't got the vaguest idea to figure out how you cross a body of water in a ferry. I usually end up taking the long route because the ferry issue defeats me.
Well, they're a little foreign to me, too, but I did live in Vancouver for a time, and I would cross. You could do the passenger ferry or the car ferry and go over to Vancouver Island. And it's a very pretty trip, but, you know, if you're on Vancouver Island, I could never live on an island because I'd feel stuck. And, if you grow up on the prairie, I think it affects how you view water.
You know,
you can't help but do that.
In my case, living most of my life on the desert, water is kind of suspicious to me. And there'd be sea monsters in there, you know, and they're called alligators and sharks.
Oh, yeah.
And, living in New Orleans, where in order to leave the city, you have to cross a bridge. And then the Katrina experience and evacuating for Katrina, it really kind of changed how I regarded living there. I mean, for the first time I became somewhat paranoid about how difficult it was to leave the city when we needed to evacuate because of the limited number of bridges. It was a bottleneck and it would clog.
Yeah.
And because you only had those ways to get out because essentially New Orleans is an island. The greater New Orleans area. You have to cross a bridge to get to something else to get away. And that's
island.
One thing I do not miss is that needing to cross a bridge to go anywhere.
Right.
You know, that's one thing that, yeah. And then we lived on the coast for the first 2 years in Mississippi, but when we started house shopping, the whole what's okay, what's not okay, it became so complicated and such a sheer pain with red tape. I said at that point, I said, you know what, I want to live someplace I don't have to evacuate and worry about storm surge ever again.
Right.
So we moved inland. We're over 100 miles from the coast, so we no longer have to worry about that. Now it's just tornadoes.
When I look at the map of Florida, I see the peninsula just dangling down there. And to me, it says, come and get me, storms. Here I am. And California scares me because of earthquakes. That's the only thing, that's the only natural disaster I have as yet to have to master. I had tornadoes
under my feet. No, I'm not real crazy about that. I was in Arizona when we had a mild earthquake. It was enough to crack a window where I was living. I didn't feel it. I was awake when we had the earthquake. I happened to be on the phone, and I was really irate at that particular moment. So when things moved, I probably didn't notice because I was so focused on being angry. Because it was late at night, and I just didn't like talking to people late at night, and especially if it was something stupid. And you know, I really didn't notice it. You know, you could see the difference in the fault line because things had moved and whatnot. But the idea of the earth moving under my feet, really, no, I don't think I'll like that very much.
And you get no warning.
Right. Right.
with blizzards and tornadoes, you get some warning. With hurricanes, you almost get too much because it's coming and it's coming and it's coming and it's 4 days, it's 3 days. Is it going to hit us? Is it going to hit Mexico? Just, it's enough to drive you crazy.
Yeah, that's true. With the hurricanes, there's plenty of warning. I know that, you know, most of my family wanted me to leave the south in the hurricane zone. And I was like, you know, if you live in Tornado Alley, you don't get much notice of a tornado coming. Oftentimes it's just a few minutes, just enough time to run into your basement if you have it. And, you know, if you live in California, it's earthquakes. If you move up north, it's blizzards. I said, there's always something. I said, at least with this, I've got plenty of notice it's coming.
Yes.
You know, a hurricane
inland
arrives unexpectedly. A blizzard can. So can a thunderstorm that delivers a tornado.
Right.
So, yeah, in terms of threats, yeah. We are running down to the last few minutes of the show, and we've been rambling about all sorts of other things. Could you tell us a little bit about more about the book that you're working on, and when is it going to be?
The book I'm working on, yes. My amateur sleuth, Austin Starr, has a good friend that she makes in Toronto. And Austin Starr starts out at age 22, and her friend Larissa is 20. And they're at the University of Toronto. And 2 years after the book Desolation Row takes place, it's summertime, and Larissa goes out to Vancouver to the University of British Columbia and takes a summer job. And she's working in a chemistry lab. And she joins a women's lib group because somebody she meets in the chemistry lab is a grad student up from Seattle, starting a women's lib group. And for various reasons, Larissa gets fingered by the Canadian, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the famous Mounties, as the killer of this women's lib person. And she's all distraught, can't leave Vancouver, so she calls her dear friend Austin and says, please come out to Vancouver and give me support. I need your support. You've been through this before with your husband when he was jailed. Please come help me. So Austin comes out, leaves her husband and her child at home, and flies out to support her good friend Larissa and starts nosing around and finds clues that the Mounties do not uncover, but she does, kind of in the vein of Nancy Drew. And hopefully when you read that one, when it gets published, Gia, you will not see who did that murder also.
Yeah, that's kind of neat, because a lot of times, you know, I'll admit, mysteries aren't really all that mysterious. You know, you see it coming, you know, a mile away, as the saying goes. But, no, in the case of Desolation Row, I didn't see it coming.
Well, you know, this, I hope this doesn't give it away, but the trick I used was I used the generation gap. You have a 22-year-old looking at older people with eyes saying somebody that old could never be a murderer. He or she doesn't have the strength or the wherewithal to commit murder. So you dismiss them because you're seeing through Austin's eyes.
And yeah, you know, the sweet little old lady couldn't possibly do that. Yeah, there's certainly there could be nothing wrong. Yeah, you know, I can see where that would be. To be honest, I have never suspected a little old lady of committing murder, even though we have seen cases where someone in their 80s or 90s has done in their spouse or someone else.
Oh, yes, yes. And sometimes just clobbering them, you know, with a heavy candlestick. Whack, Harold! I'm fed up.
Yeah. And, you know, they were married for 50-some years, and their kids said they were happy all the time. And, you know, one or the other did the other one in. you know, on their 58th anniversary or something.
Right.
You know, and those cases seem to be kind of out of the blue, too.
Yeah, but they do happen.
Yeah, they do happen, you know, and you know, I guess my opinion of older people is shifting since I now am what I once considered so old, I may as well be dead.
I remember when I turned 30, I thought, I can't listen to rock music anymore and I can't wear jeans. Honest to God, that's the truth. And I was wrong, I'm happy to say.
I was glad because I was very concerned I'd broken another, you know, rule of society because I'm ever so much more than 20, as Wendy said in Peter Pan, and I still wear jeans.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I saw Gloria Steinem in the flesh 2 weeks ago. She was here giving a speech. I thought I was going to levitate. I was so ecstatic. I gave her a copy of my book, and I said, my next one's going to be about women's lib. And she's 89 and still looks terrific. She was wearing hip hugger black pants and a groovy black leather with silver stud belts and a black turtleneck and looked ravishing. So, right on, baby.
Well, I have to admit, I would probably never wear that particular outfit because also with age has come infirmities you know, all that brilliant, those brilliant ideas that I have in my head began to expand to the point that they would no longer fit in there. So they began occupying other parts of my body.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So, you know, I'm twice the woman I was at 20. And also, you know, I tend to dress for comfort. I could care less about fashion. My daughter often looks at me and says, you're going to town in that? Sure, why not? Nobody here knows me, but they know me. Like, well, sorry. I'm demented or something. I've got Alzheimer's. I don't care. Yeah.
That's cute. Well, Gloria Steinem, I think she gave the lie to the men who said only unsightly women were in women's lib. She was always gorgeous, and she'd stand up and speak well and look slim, and she still does, and bully for her.
Yep, exactly. You know,
I think she's a size 2. And, I mean, when I saw her up close and personal, I really couldn't believe it because I thought she's so slim that you think that she's taller than she is. But I'd say she was maybe 5'2 and wore size 2. I was shocked. But then I'm 5'10", so everybody's a little short.
Well, I'm short. My sister was actually my baby sister was a little taller than you, so she was taller than me for forever. But, folks, we have run out of time. So you want to tell everybody real quick the title of your book and where to get it?
It's Desolation Row by Kay Kendall. You can buy it online at all the usual places. And I hope you do read it and enjoy it. Thank you, Gia. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you. And, folks, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I hope that tonight's program has given you some entertainment as well as plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea as we continue our author's conversation series. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.